Great. Well, it's 4:30. I expect people to be along shortly. Welcome to our pre-gala clubhouse. I'm thrilled to have two of the best philosophers out there today, Atlas Society Senior Scholar Stephen Hicks and Atlas Society Founder David Kelly. They'll be answering our questions for the next 90 minutes, which should give more time for detailed answers. I want to encourage everyone to share the room, and please raise your hand if you have a question for the scholars. I also have a list of my own from social media. So welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for doing this format. Any opening comments, or you want us just to jump right into questions?
Well, I just want to say it's always an honor to share the stage with the great David Kelly. So let's have fun.
Well, that feeling is mutual. And thank you, Scott, too, for moderating. So let's go at it.
All right, good. Well, we've got Mark joining us. Let's jump right in with Mark's question.
Hi, everybody. I would like to hear what would be the highest level 20,000 foot explanation of what the practice of philosophy is even for. In other words, not so much detail, but what is it meant to bring a person by studying philosophy?
Good one.
I'm sorry, but I missed the key noun in your question, Mark.
What is the benefit to a person
benefit
to be studying and practicing philosophy from the 20,000 foot view?
Okay. Well, let me take a stab at that one first. I would say that the value of philosophy is as a practical tool for living your life. And it's a practical tool because human beings are a smart species, or at least a potentially smart species. And how we survive and flourish is by understanding the world around us, understanding our own needs and capacities, making plans for our lives, that is to say, choosing goals, developing ourselves into the kinds of beings that can achieve those goals in the real world. And when you set your mind to answering those questions, you are inescapably led to philosophical questions about the nature of reality, the nature of human beings, what genuine goals are, and then somewhat self-reflectively, how you come up with answers to all of those questions and know that those answers are good answers. So the questions of philosophy, the metaphysical issues about the nature of reality, about human beings, about our core values, about the capacity for shaping our character and then acting in the world, all of those philosophical questions bear on what you come up with. And your philosophy is your hopefully thoughtful and integrated set of answers to those questions.
I would add to Stephen's point, the fact that this is a point that was stressed by Ayn Rand, you can't escape philosophy in a sense, because your whole life you make choices, many choices every day. Some are habitual, some are major. But what choices you make depend on what you think the world is like, that's metaphysics, how you think you know it, and what your values are, what are you living for, what's good and bad for you in your life. And so that's an implicit philosophy. If you look at any emotion, you'll see assumptions about other people, about the world, about yourself, and they may be expressed only implicitly in the form of emotions, but the assumptions are there, and bringing them out into the open and considering them consciously and deliberately and rationally is all to the good. I don't think that means that everyone has to be a professional philosopher. The world would be a disaster if that were true, because no one would be running the businesses or the school buses or whatever. But everyone, I think, needs some basic knowledge of philosophy, just in the sense that, by analogy, maybe with everyone should know how to count, add, subtract, multiply. Ideally, you know, a little more from your algebra class, but still, you don't have to be a professional mathematician to use math. And in the same way, you don't have to be a professional philosopher to think about philosophy.
Well, one of the first things that Stephen said, almost the first sentence, was something along the lines of living a good life. So could it be that if one were restricted to 6 to 10 words, could one say that philosophy is about how to live a good life? Would that suffice?
That's the ultimate. I would say that, yes, that's the ultimate reason. But that question carries a lot of sub-questions, implications, and so forth. But yeah, I'm happy with that answer.
Thank you.
Of the fact that we had choice. Sure.
Good. Thank you for that. I want to encourage people in the room to ask questions, but I also have a large stack. Here's one for Stephen. Biltmore asks, you posted about the state of Florida arguing its teachers don't have economic freedom because they're state employees. But isn't their argument correct?
Yeah. I think that one comes out of the context of contemporary discussions about education, both K through 12 and in higher education, and whether various woke agendas or CRT agendas have captured portions of schools and universities. And then whether it's appropriate for governments, local governments, state governments, perhaps federal governments, to correct for this by imposing various sorts of legislation to restrict the teaching of CRT or woke. And some state-level governments, Florida is one of them, have gone pretty far down that road of enacting legislation of various sorts that says, you know, woke ideas and woke texts can't be used in the classrooms or put on the curricula and so on. So that then is to say there's an ideology that's judged to be dangerous, but it has some power in the schools and universities, and then whether a political response is the best way to correct for this. Now, further context is that particularly by the time one gets to higher education, colleges and universities, there are long cherished institutions to protect academic freedom in various ways, tenure, and then various kind of explicit prohibitions on restricting speech, giving professors total control over the content of their courses and so on. So then what we have is politicians on the one hand wanting to say certain ideologies are wrong, and in our role as kind of our fiduciary responsibility to our citizens in state institutions to make sure that state monies are being used to promote actual education and not ideas that we think aren't education, justified in regulating the content of what's taught in the universities and thereby abridging academic freedom, or whether we should say academic freedom is the more important value, and therefore the politicians have to stay out of it. And one of the sub-arguments then is the one that's referred to here that's used by the states, which is to say, well, yes, you guys are professors at universities, but we're going to say more importantly, since these universities are state institutions, you are first and foremost employees of the state. And as employees of the state, you have to do what the state tells you. And so if the governor or the state legislature says you can't espouse certain ideas in the classroom, then that trumps, so to speak, your academic freedom. Now, I think that argument is right, but I don't think it's the argument that we should go with. There is an inescapable contradiction between those two positions. If you're going to have politicians in the education space, you know, then politics ultimately is an act of force, and people who are political employees have to follow the rules, and those can be backed up by force. And the contradiction then is with the pursuit of truth, which is the primary job of people in higher education. And the pursuit of truth doesn't operate under forceful or compulsory operation. So there's a contradiction there that can't be squared or resolved in the context, can't be resolved consistently in the context of politically funded education. So then it comes down to a matter of which side of the contradiction you think holds the more important value, and you're just going to live with the inconsistency. So in this case, I would say, yes, it's perfectly logical to say as a state employee, academic freedom is going to be judged from that context to be a lesser value and to be overridden when the politicians think appropriate. But I think the better way to do this would be to stick with, at least for the foreseeable future, while we are going to have public education, is to stick with the tradition of saying that public universities are an exemption to kind of normal employment contract law or normal bureaucratic rationality. And to see academic freedom as such an important value, and the pursuit of truth and the debate and so on, that we're going to have a kind of Chinese wall inside the public institutions between the funding source and the politicians on the one side and the professors on the other side, so that there will be a kind of feudal right, kind of hearkening back to universities and their feudal roots, that will give them an exemption to do their special job, which is pursuing truth without fear of any sort of political imposition. I think that compromise has worked well in the context of public or government education in the modern world. And I think it's a bad idea to try to override that compromise for the sake of fighting off, you know, a particularly noxious set of ideas that happen to be current now.
Great, good, detailed answer. Again, for those just joining us, we want to invite you to the stage. If you have questions for Dr. Kelly or Dr. Hicks and Tom, thank you for joining us. You always have some good, deep questions. What you got for us today?
Thank you, Scott. And first, let me make a comment. I have a few more questions than just one, but Clubhouse does not offer another way to a way to raise the hand again. So that's just another comment. But the question I have is, and maybe David can answer in 6 minutes and double space for this question. And that is one of your essays, maybe a long time ago, talks about the two kinds of public, the concept of public. One is implicitly invited interaction, and the other one not. And I was wondering what reference, what source did you find during the Enlightenment that gave you that distinction, because I couldn't find it in the essay originally. So that's the question. And then, of course, the follow-up for that is, what is the distinguishing characteristic of a republic?
Let me thank you. I said, oh my goodness, that's a heavy one. But let me just say about the concept of public. the two concepts of the public I was trying to outline in that article. One was, there's some things that the public is, as you say, is implicitly invited. I can go into a restaurant and I'm not crashing the party, so to speak. In my home, that's private. You don't come unless you're invited. So, and that's an age-old distinction. So I think it predates the Enlightenment, although pre-Enlightenment, Stephen can correct me if I'm, he's, you know, misleading on this, but at pre-Enlightenment, I think more of life was public in the sense that you had to answer to the church as well as the state on a number of counts. And there, one of the great things about the Enlightenment was it recognized that individuals, the basis of society is individuals, their aims and aspirations and thoughts and choices. So that did elevate the sense of privacy. There are so many sources on this and so many commentaries about it, that it'd be hard to pin down just one. But the other concept of public means supported by government, that is public. Public education means education supported, paid for by the state, which means by the taxpayers, and anything like that. And what the point of my article was, people are engaged in equivocation between those two concepts when they say, well, for example, in civil rights laws, say you're a restaurant, you're open to the public, so that's a public function, and the public gets to say how you conduct it. That's confusing the public as political and the public as a form of commercial reality, by voluntary commercial reality. So that's the distinction I was making. Again, I don't know. I referred to a couple of, in that article, I referred to a couple of contemporary authors who I thought had committed that fallacy of equivocation. But beyond that, I don't really have a whole lot to say. But I think I'm less than 6 minutes in. The other question you had was about, I'm sorry, remind me this second half of the question, the second question.
It is the distinguishing characteristic of a republic.
Yes. It's interesting that the etymological roots of the concept of republic is res publica, the things that are common or in the public sphere. Goes back at least to the Romans. But a republic in the political, modern meaning, last two, you know, post-Enlightenment, a republic is one in which that recognizes the primacy of individuals and regards the government as a means to protect them, and particularly their violation of their rights. It may provide other services, as our government does, and keeps adding to those functions, but it is still bound by the concept of a republic, an individualist republic, and by our constitution, which reflects that, to legislate fairly and equally among individuals, and it normally means a democratic form of choosing leaders, and in some cases choosing policies that those leaders must follow. So it's a combination of things. I would say a republic is a form of government in which the rule of law protects individuals, elections are for office are open and settled by democratic means. That's as much, far as I can condense it off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Great. Chris, welcome. Good to see you.
Hello. Yeah. Question for both of you. Do you think academia can be salvaged? And how did academia get this way? Does it just naturally attract charlatans, or what can we do to save the colleges, or should we just give up?
Wow, Stephen.
I think I should take that one. The current resident of the academic world of the two of us. Let me say, I think many of our universities are in great shape overall. Obviously, there are problems. There are big problems, and there are subsectors of many colleges and universities that are in fact disaster zones. But if you take universities as a whole, you know, what's going on in the medical schools, in many cases in the business schools, in the sciences, and even in many places in the humanities and social sciences, there's a lot of great, great stuff that goes on. But all that said, I think things are worse than they were, say, 10 years ago, 20 years, and now 30 years ago when I started off as a young academic. So we are seriously into postmodern nihilism, skepticism, relativism, and all of the offshoot organizations. And they've done a significant amount of damage over the last 20 or 30 years. So all of the journalism on that, I think, is true. Now, whether the universities can be salvaged, I don't think that's quite the right question, because I don't think they are beyond salvage or in a state where even the salvage question is the right word to be using there. The question, I think, is better, will they reform themselves sufficiently or not? And I am cautiously optimistic that they will. One thing to keep in mind is that universities and colleges are meant to be places that are kind of like hothouses where strange plants are going to be grown and experimented with, if I can use that analogy. So it is the place where it's precisely the job of academics to take or to consider all sorts of ideas and then to debate them. And sometimes part of the occupational hazard, so to speak, of that is that some weird ideas are going to get currency, and they're going to have a prominent position for a while. But the idea of having colleges and universities where these debates are going on is that they will be argued with, and if the ideas are in fact terrible ideas, they ultimately will get weeded out. That the universities then will be self-correcting. Now, I think we are starting to see that happening just in the last 7 or 8 years ago. I think it is true to say that we were all largely asleep at the switch in the 1990s and on into the early 2000s. The Soviet Union collapsed. Everything is good. Some sort of liberal democracy is going to prevail, life is good, and then there was this cancer, as I think of it, switching my metaphors a little bit here, of postmodernism that got its footholds and then became worse and worse, and then we didn't start to become aware of it, more broadly speaking, until, say, the middle part of 2010. So Jordan Peterson, Steven Pinker, Jonathan Haidt, and others step up and say, hey, we've got a big problem here. We need to push back. So that, I think, already is part of the reform process happening. Other professors inside the academic world recognizing that there's a serious problem and then marshaling their arguments and institutional muscle to push back. Now, things do move kind of slowly in the academic world. So it's not going to be a reform that happens overnight, but I do think that now we've got not only dozens of first-rate people, but hundreds of first-rate people, if not thousands of first-rate people in colleges and universities who are aware of the problem. They're getting up to speed. They're fighting back, and so I think we will win the arguments. So I think at the same time, There's a significant amount of wealth and technological resources available for people to start new kinds of colleges and universities. And there's a very interesting large amount of activity starting to happen in the last 10 years or so in that area. So I think that the universities that do go down the self-destructive paths, that they don't succeed in internally reforming themselves, they will be marginalized. A lot of them will just go out of existence. The ones that do, in fact, succeed in reforming themselves and offering well-rounded, healthy education, they will survive on into the next generation, and they will be joined with, by a lot of ones that are now in the entrepreneurial stage, the startup phase, that have some new ideas about how higher education can be done well, and they will prove themselves. So that's just to answer the first part of your question about whether I think it can be salvaged / reformed or not. As for how we got into there, let's save that one. That's a longer question. Maybe we can come back to that.
Yeah, that can be its own topic. Dana, it's been a while. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. My question concerns presentism. I've had some encounters with it over the last few weeks and find myself victimized by it sometimes. Then that is trying to judge philosophers and others in terms of what's currently understood about things. And it's to some extent, it came up in a discussion about Kant a couple of weeks ago, his defense against science, and to be fair, he hadn't come up against some of the better ideas about science at the time. So it wasn't fair. It's not fair to criticize him on that behalf. Now, the same thing's true with Ayn Rand, I think. I mean, there are criticisms of things she said at particular times that are that people try to judge in terms of what we know now. And then the final thing was is the American Historical Association rejected its president's call to be careful about presentism, that historians shouldn't condemn people for what was going on at the time. So I guess my question is, how does one discipline oneself with regard to presentism?
I can jump in on just a couple of points. This issue arose in a big way with the taking down all the Confederate statues in Virginia and elsewhere in the South, and including some in Washington, D.C., where I live, and elsewhere, because they did not, the South was defending slavery, among other things, and that's, you know, not acceptable. But the fact is that slavery was part of every society in human history up to the late 18th century, as I understand it, and it was only the liberal movements of the day and individuals' movements that countered it. So, you know, history moves by steps, and I don't think, I think if you're talking about history, whether intellectual history, like the history of philosophy, or actual, you know, the events and people and trends that historians study, historians of all people should hold context. You know, their whole job is to figure out what was happening and why, what were the people involved thinking. And the same, I think, applies to some extent to philosophers. You know, if philosophers like anyone else, take certain things for granted from their culture. They're better equipped maybe to identify those assumptions and bring them to consciousness and criticize them if there's errors with it. But there's so many things, you know, Aristotle, he came up with the best argument he could think of because it was a universal practice at the time. It was deeply woven into the way Greek and then later Roman society was organized. So yeah, that wasn't good. I would have wished that he would say, wait a minute. But he didn't. It was like 2 centuries before he would be in a position to say that. And certainly with Rand, you know, yeah, she was partly a creature of her times. Some of the things she said about sexuality, homosexuality, and so forth, I think you reflected more of the culture of the 50s and 60s and earlier than a hard, sharp philosophical claim. And so one of the things that culture does that can help philosophers is bring certain issues into the open so that they can be examined. But I still think philosophy is the best way of examining them and holding context in historical issues, because, you know, the social warriors today are hardly omniscient, and they're less close to omniscience than a lot of other people I can think of, including present company. But so they should have a little more, I hate to call it humility, but a little more objectivity about the limits of their knowledge. Okay, I'll just stop there.
Let me jump in on that. I think that's very well said, David. For me, when I think about this question, it is definitely the contextual framing is the important one. So with respect to presentism, I think it depends what question you are asking. So if we look back at historical figures in politics, in philosophy, or wherever, and they had certain ideas and espoused certain values, if your question is that idea true? And I think that's always the great question to ask. Then presentism is fine. I think you should be able to take your present context of knowledge and everything we have discovered since that person into account in making a judgment call about whether you agree with that person's ideas or not, whether it's Kant or Locke or Aristotle or Rand. And in some cases, we will say, okay, given what we now know, in the present day, I can usually say that that person's idea or ideas were false. But if your question is different, and this is often the historian's question or the intellectual historian's question, where you put yourself in the time context of that person in history. So you put yourself in Kant's shoes, or you put yourself in Aristotle's sandals, and you say, what could I expect Aristotle to come up with, given everything that was known in his time? Then at that point, the 2020 hindsight becomes inappropriate. You can't bring in later knowledge to judge in that context. So then you start to say, yes, he came up with an idea that was wrong, but in the context within which he was operating, it wasn't a stupid wrong thing to come up with, or even necessarily an immoral wrong thing to come up with. And so you have a more nuanced contextual judgment. So I think with respect to presentism, just getting clear what question you are asking of that historical person will help clarify what kind of judgment you should be making.
Great. Let me just add one thing to Stephen's great comment there, and that is that there's an analogy here with cognitive bias called hindsight bias, which is something, and this is, occurs at the individual level, individual mind. Something happens, you make a choice, and something bad happens, and you look back and say, oh, I should have known that. Well, no, that's an out of context judgment, because you didn't know at the time you made that choice what you now know. And you could say it's really, you could maybe say that the presentists are engaged in confirmation bias and blaming past thinkers and past leaders, political leaders and societies for not grasping what they claim to have grasped today.
Great. Thank you for that. Nina, we chatted the other day. I hope you're going to ask something about what we chatted about.
Yes, thanks, Scott. So we're seeing a growing reliance in research sphere on lived experiences, standpoint epistemology. I see it in areas like government-funded public policy research. And I was hoping you could help me articulate an objectivist kind of critique or position on reliance on this idea of lived experience, really personal anecdotes and perspectives getting heavy amounts of weight.
Okay, I'll jump in, Stephen. I know you have thoughts about this as well, but the standpoint epistemology is, as I understand it, is the view that what people believe, the contents of their minds, are shaped by their experience, which in turn is shaped by their group identity, culture, race, sex, all the other, you know, basic features that are, you know, at the top of the list today. And so stated in that way, that is a form of relativism. It says, you know, existence, it's like saying we either, existence doesn't exist, it isn't what it is, but varies for every individual, or that it may be what, you know, an absolute, but we can never know it. So either choice is bad news. I do think that, however, there is a fundamental issue in psychology and the social sciences, which is we want scientific methods, logical methods for forming generalizations and detecting patterns. But so far, anyway, those methods that are, you know, you see in every a paper in academic psychology or social psychology, is it leaves out a lot. It abstracts from a lot of things. In objectivist terms, it omits so many measurements that may turn out to be quite relevant in the form of how individuals experience it. So we're empiricists. I think we should pay a lot of attention to experience. And I think it's very broadening for students in particular to be educated in and have experience of other cultures just as a way of, undercovering some of their own assumptions. And the same is true within a society of different groups within it. But that does not justify either, you know, primacy of consciousness views about knowledge or skepticism about whether there is a truth.
Yeah, I agree with David's remarks. I think there are two sub issues here. Broadly speaking, objectivists are empiricists, so we start with experience, and experience always is of an individual in a particular context. And so lowercase standpoint epistemology makes sense in that regard. But as a term of art or as a more full-fledged epistemology, like there are two false versions of it that then get currency in the humanities, but also in the social science literature. One is the one that David was referring to at the beginning, where we then say the individual's initial standpoint isn't autonomous cognitively, but rather that individual's experience is shaped by prior and previous group memberships along various dimensions that the individual is born into and shaped by. So you end up with a kind of collectivized initial starting point. And then in the strong forms, the individual is seen just as a vehicle through which those various collective epistemologies and collective viewpoints are funneled and channeled. And in that case, and I think that's a false understanding. The other dimension David started to talk about in the second part, but I just wanted to flag this one a little bit, is there's a traditional danger in empiricism that says when you start with individual experiences, you can never get to generalizations or to universal principles. And often standpoint epistemology, with now the capital letters, is in that skeptical tradition. It basically says, you know, we can never come up with grand theories or grand narratives. All we ever have are things that are going on at a very local individual level. And so the best we can do is just all of us tell our anecdotes, and nobody's anecdotes really are better than anyone else's. And we're never really going to try to make the effort of generalizing from these various anecdotes. So it's a retreat from doing some kind of social science in a robust form to just storytelling. And I think that's another false epistemology in operation.
Good, thank you for that. I've seen some talk of autoethnography, which is, you know, almost turning science into writing a diary. But again, I want to encourage people to join us. Again, if you, I have a list of questions here myself. One thing that I was curious about, logical positivism was something that Rand often railed about, but you never hear about it. Did it morph into something else, or, you know, did it, is it still around?
That's a good question. It did sort of disappear. I mean, I went to grad school with people who were still like Carl Hempel, who was connected with the Vienna School, the logical positivists. But I think it just petered out because it couldn't solve any problems. I don't know, Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, logical positivism, again, capital L, capital P, was a school that was very powerful in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And it did start to peter out by the time we got to the 1950s. Although I'm a little bit younger, I still had heavy doses of logical positivism in my undergraduate and graduate school experience as well. But it was, I'd say, broadly speaking, one of the subschools in the more analytic approach to philosophy, where what we're trying to do is be very careful and precise and analyze all of our concepts and where they come and how we combine them in various ways. And initially, it did start off as a science-friendly approach to doing philosophy, that we don't want to be, you know, speculative, head in the clouds, word salad kind of philosophers, like the worst of the continental philosophers coming out of Hegel and Kierkegaard and Heidegger and so on, that we think science is the right way to go about understanding the world. So we're going to be positivistic as a term of art there, instead of metaphysical. And at the same time, we are going to be logical rather than emotional moody, subjective, and so on. So initially, then, it was meant to be philosophy as the handmaiden of the science, and to work with the scientists and sharpen all of their analytical and conceptual tools so they can figure out the way the world works. The problem was that in their, or the series of problems was that in their understanding of all of the major elements that go into scientific method, from sense perception to directed observation to concept formation to logic and mathematics, all of the basic principles that they took to be true and were working within turned out to be false and to lead to skeptical dead ends. So they started off with, I would say, high hopes in the generation immediately following World War One, the Vienna Circle, and then very influential in England, and then a little bit later in American philosophy. But then, as the implications of their axioms got worked out, by the time people got to the 40s and 50s, it was seen as a failed research program.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Let me just add something to Stephen's narrative. The logical positivists build themselves as empiricists who are only looking at the evidence of the senses and people of logical rigor. The problem is that their view of perception was Humean, that it or representationless. We only see images, and we have to prove that they stand for something out in the world. And the logic they accepted was that of the Frege-Russell symbolic logic tradition, which has a number of paradoxes in it and is not particularly, has no theory of concepts to speak of. So they were trying to concoct symbolic logic proofs. I know this is opaque that people haven't looked at this before, but they tried to concoct proofs of various kinds, but all on the basis of really bad assumptions, which they often never questioned. So I think that was part of the problem. But I will say that those same underlying assumptions, human skepticism, and the view that symbolic logic is the only valid, reasonable, rational logic, those are still front and center. They're still active in philosophy, at least in many realms of philosophy. So the logical positivists may have crashed, but their underlying assumptions and impulses have not crashed. They're still present.
Good stuff. Thank you. Lawrence, thanks for joining us. Oh, go ahead. Actually, did you want to add something?
If you don't mind, Scott, can I just say just one more thing to David's very good points about the perception and the nature of logic? Another one of the assumptions the logical positivists bought into, all of them, had to do with values. They had a very strong fact-value dichotomy, and the assumption was that anything in the value range, moral values, political values, aesthetic values, was non-logical, and so should not even be part of philosophy. So basically, right from the very beginning, in the 20s and 30s, their operative position was going to be that philosophically, those areas are not even part of philosophy and should be, in effect, banished to the wilderness. And so one implication of that in philosophy more broadly was that then all of the value issues in philosophy, there was a vacuum in the logical positivist tradition that was then picked up by people who wanted to do value philosophy, but on a non-logical, non-empirical basis. And that led to all sorts of irrationalist schools of value philosophy, particularly in the continental traditions, becoming ascendant in the middle part of the 20th century.
Thanks, Stephen. That's a great point.
Good add-on. Thank you. Lawrence, do you have a question?
Yeah, thanks for having this. So my question isn't perhaps one of the, maybe it's not as philosophical as is appropriate for this clubhouse, but I was still curious, perhaps it's more psychology, but I was studying anarcho movements. And one thing that I noticed, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, anarchism was sort of this big thing that had movements and a lot of violence and, you know, assassinations and such. They were sort of making a lot of moves in their own field. But that all really seemed to die off with the prevalence of socialism and communism, sort of collective and more collectivist ideals. And I'm curious if there's any philosophical sort of understanding or evidence maybe suggesting why there was sort of this departure from the anarchists and the Jacobins and more towards you know, social. Was there just something more philosophically fulfilling, I guess, for these types of people? Maybe that's more along the lines of psychology, though.
I think that's a great history, intellectual history, political history question. Let me take a quick stab at it. I too have read some of the late 1800s anarchists, and your point, Lawrence, is quite right about how vigorous and active they were in the latter part of the 1800s and on into the early part of the 20th century. All of the bombings and assassinations and, you know, hundreds of little cells all over Europe and some in North America as well, and on into to Russia as well. I've never actually thought about this, but my sense is that the reason why they died out in activity was due to the consequences of World War I, 1914 to 1918, and then the success of the Russian Revolution in 1917. So both of those historical events took people who were attracted to anarchism and then pushed them into one of two other far-left camps. World War I meant that what happened was not any sort of anarchist communist revolution. It was obviously a huge event. But the people on the far left took from World War I the view that, or like some of them did, that nationalist sentiments and nationalist commitments were much stronger than they had anticipated. And so what happened to a lot of people who were on the far left was they repackaged them in a more fascistic direction. And Benito Mussolini is a very clear example of this, as someone who was very much on the far left, thought in terms of revolutionary, blow the whole world up, and then we will build a new society in which there's the brotherhood of all mankind, coming to realize that really it was French national feeling and Italian national feeling and English and German and Russian national feeling that was extraordinarily powerful. And so all of that left-leaning revolutionism needs to be channeled through more ethnic and nationalistic lines. And so that then led to a huge amount of what we now would call fascistic or national socialistic activity in the 1920s and on into the 1930s. And that took a lot of people who might have continued on the anarchist path in a different direction. The other, I think, was the success of the Russian Revolution. Marx was second, third rate kind of guy by the time we get to the end of the 1800s. Just another name kicking around there. He had his followers and so on. But I think the success of the Russian Revolution meant that suddenly here is a version of socialism and that's now in control of a major country in the world. And the people who were running it had flirted with anarchism, had flirted with various sorts of revolutionary socialism. But it turns out that, of course, that Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky, they were Marxists. And this was extraordinarily exciting to people on the far left all over the world. And so what happened then was people who might have been attracted to anarchism that said, well, I'm basically going to bet on this winning horse. And so they became much more enamored with and kind of signed on to Marxist, Leninist, or Bolshevik approaches to communism. So basically, I think those two historical events took people who might have been attracted to anarchism in that generation, but gave them two live options that seemed to have some traction. And so all of the anarchist potential membership went into one of those two groups.
Great. Thank you for that. We've got Chrissy. Welcome to the stage.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for ringing me up. And thanks, Stephen and David, for having this in the Atlas Society tonight. I think it's to both of you guys, but more or less to David when I was driving listening. I found that it was really interesting when you were talking about the Republic. And it rose that feeling in me of like for the Republic and which it stands. You know, I'm like, I heard what you were saying, and maybe I might be reaching here, but throughout history, from what I know and my knowledge of it, humbly, it sounds as though to become the true American Republic for which it stands and everything that I hold dear as an American, it means that there must be, otherwise there would be tyranny, a separation of church and state. And that's what it was able to establish and accomplish. So it wasn't just we had government control, but on top of that, we had to then, before even going to that, it was superseded by the church. And to that, I guess, and I kind of feel as though, and I don't want to speculate, but David, it sounds like, well, both of you, amazing, very accomplished, published philosophers, dumb little me, but it sounds like, David, that it's coming from at least a spirit of someone that would be either agnostic or atheist. And so I guess my question would be, and I know this might be dabbling like philosophy and theology in one, which is where my brain gets really confused. Can you equate in your eyes how the separation of church and state could potentially have, although started at a good place and for a good reason, be very convoluted, especially today in modern day society, meaning that those of religious aspects are basically shunned. Sorry.
Either of you want to take that?
Sorry, I was muted. I didn't realize I was muted. Chrissy, that's a really important question. Let me just throw out a couple of thoughts. The idea of religious tolerance, religious freedom, and the separation of church and state goes back, you know, at least to Milton in the, I think it was 1600s in England, and to John Locke, who were saying, you know, we should not, and with the background of the Hundred Years' War, in which a lot of people were killed over religious differences between Protestants and Catholics or different sects of Protestantism. But so the idea was around, and I think, I've never really studied this, but I think the founders had a sense that the purpose of government is to protect individuals in their rights. And those rights include freedom of conscience, as well as freedom of speech, the right to own property and not have it taken without a good public reason. Freedom from unreasonable seizures and searches, all the things that had plagued earlier societies in one form or another. And so religious freedom was important, but it didn't mean atheism or agnosticism necessarily. You could be, but the majority of you know, the founders, I think, had some religious belief. Very good historian of the Enlightenment, Stephen, you remember his, you may remember his name, founder of FIRE at the University of Pennsylvania.
Alan Charles Kors.
Alan Kors, yes. I remember asking him, well, how come there wasn't more atheism at the time? And he said, well, that was pre-Darwin, so people could not understand how the world could be so species could be so well calibrated to their environment without a designer. Anyway, the broad point is that we are not like France, a laity society that is founded on the idea of atheism or agnosticism. We are founded on the idea of freedom. And so many people understand that. They don't want to kill their Muslim neighbors or their Jewish neighbors. I mean, that unfortunately, there's been a certain amount of that, but not like the wars of religion in ancient times or the wars that are happening in the Middle East now, people hating each other just because of their religion. And that's fine. That's the way it should be. Belief, government should, and here's the basic point, the go-to point. I am an atheist, as an objectivist. I don't see any reason for that belief. However, that's my exercise of my freedom of thought and conviction, and I respect everyone else's, you know, whatever they believe, so long as it does not violate my rights. So there's another a wrap-up point here. I'm sorry. All right, Stephen, help me out here.
Yeah, let me jump in on that. I think also, Chrissy, that's a great question. And also on this agnosticism, atheism issue, I agree with David that was not the historically operative point during the Enlightenment, particularly in the United States. The nation was founded on the idea of freedom. But the thing I want to add is that the freedom was conceived of in individualistic terms. So what that meant was, with respect to religion, that whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or a theist or whatever, that for your beliefs to have meaning and significance and actually to do you good in your life, they have to be things that you as an individual have come to believe by your own thinking processes. And so it wasn't agnostics and atheists who were only pushing for separation of church and state. You know, their argument might be, we don't want to have, you know, the state pushing religious views on me or particular religious views that I disagree with if I'm an early atheist or an agnostic person. But the most powerful arguments for separation of church and state came from religious people who wanted to say the instruments of the state, coercion, and so on, are completely ineffectual in the area of religion. You can't compel people to believe things that are actually true and good for them. The only way religious belief can work properly is if I believe it wholeheartedly, right, for myself as an individual. And so that's to say my individual free will and commitment has to be involved. And so, and this is a Lockean argument, and there are shades of it also in John Mill, that says the state is completely irrelevant and the completely wrong social institution for genuine religion. And so it was very strong theists also who were arguing for a conception of freedom, individual freedom in the domain of religion as a value that needs to be protected. And that means the state has to be hands off.
And one additional point, the First Amendment and the issue here of freedom of religion is cast in terms of religion as a very important kind of belief about ethics and about the world, a very important kind of philosophy for many people. But the more general principle is the state should not be enforcing any set of ideas. It should not be subsidizing any set of ideas. And so, you know, Thomas Jefferson said it is evil to force a man to pay for things he disbelieves and abhors. Well, you could say that not just about enforcing religion, having an established church, but also about having government support the arts in the form of the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities. It's another thing. All the research that doesn't, that some government research is fine if it helps the defense of the country, but most of it is just throwing money at academics. And everyone's paying for it, whether they believe or agree with those academics or not. And now they're paying for public universities, which, to return to an earlier issue, is, you know, really wildly against what a lot of people believe. So I would.
I mean, I totally agree. I just wanted to follow up. I couldn't agree more. And in fact, it's not just what I've noticed. I feel it's not so much that society in the United States as a whole has worried so much about not giving the idea of not being persecuted for the ability to have a faith or of any religion. Name any religion here. It's more of the subtraction. It's more of the it's been allowed to go too far, and so let's not let it go any farther, and let's take any kind of faith or religion out of. And to me, I think that the founding fathers, whether they were atheist or of any particular faith or not, I think that the whole idea was to just hands off, like don't touch it, you know. And I just don't see that. And humbly, again, as a dumb 37-year-old girl roaming around and hearing things that I hear in real life or in social audio and media or even on the news, I mean, like, you don't really see that. Moreover, you see the latter. And it sounded more historically and amazing, confirmed, I guess, from both of you. So thank you.
Thank you. I do want to try to get in our last three, if possible. David, do you have any quick follow-up?
Let's move on.
Okay. Ron, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your patience.
Thanks for including me. I'm a listener today.
Okay. No question. That's fine. Stephen looked like he was ready to go.
Yes, I appreciate, I Googled you, Stephen, and I used to run the one of the Ayn Rand forum sites on Facebook. It was large, probably about 5,000-7,000 people, and I've had very good interactions with the people at the Atlas Society, and I saw that you have an event that's coming up tomorrow. I retweeted that for you to hopefully get some attention. Here's my thoughts for either Stephen or David or both. Is I think one of the most valuable things today is genuine feedback loops, meaning bringing people in that come from a very diverse number of backgrounds. One of the things that has been disappointing is I don't think too many people from the Atlas Society or that have objectivist type of views get many seats at the table. And here's one of the reasons I'm bringing that up. Is I think best ideas have to win today, and best ideas, regardless of which direction they're coming from, and counting the cost, seeing which is the very best idea to solve the most difficult problems. And I would like to know who you guys think are the best people at putting together genuine feedback loops where they're able to bring in people that come from various faith backgrounds, various political backgrounds, various economic backgrounds, and bring them to a table for constructive conversation. Who is the very best at doing that right now? I think we've been able to pull some pretty cool ones off here on Clubhouse, but I'd like to know any feedback you guys have with who's the very best at bringing people from diverse faith, diverse political, and diverse economic backgrounds together in one place to bring a place where they have a place at the table. I found it happening through thankfulness, encouragement, and forward thinking. Those principles seem very uniting, but I'd love to know principles that would bring people together. And ideally, who are three or four examples of people, three or four people examples that you think these are great people at bringing diverse people from diverse backgrounds together, especially on the political front, especially on the faith front? Who are the very best people that you come to mind for you guys that are good at bringing diverse opinions to the table to come up with great solutions? Love to hear any thoughts you guys both have on that.
Wow. Stephen, you've been more active.
I nominate both of them. Oh, sorry.
So, say it again.
I said, I nominate both of them.
Right. Thank you. Stephen, I want to let you jump in because you've had more experience. You're more active with your interviews with Jordan Peterson and some other headliners. But there are, let me just sketch a little outline of a project. Some years ago, I was writing about culture, reading a lot and analyzing it, and came up with a distinction between the pre-modern culture that basically cultural conservatism, which is steeped in religion, tradition, and so forth, modernism, which is the Enlightenment view, and postmodernism, which is a conscious reaction against the Enlightenment, against modernism. And one of the reasons I did that was to find out who out there are persuadable. And I came up with the thought that people in the Enlightenment camp, even whether or not they're objectivists, are potentially persuadable because they believe in reason, they have an instinct toward individualism. The pre-moderns and the post-moderns, no, there's no hope with them. Their views are too ingrained and surrounded with too many emotions. So I've been looking at we're talking about maybe reviving this, but some of the people that Stephen mentioned earlier, Jonathan Haidt, who are active in the educational issues, but also are thinkers in their own right. Jonathan Haidt, the pre-moderns and the post-moderns, no, there's no hope with them. Their views are too ingrained and surrounded with too many emotions. So I've been looking at we're talking about maybe reviving this, but some of the people that Stephen mentioned earlier, Jonathan Haidt, who are active in the educational issues, but also are thinkers in their own right. Jonathan Haidt, Alan Kors, whom we've mentioned. These are, Alan's getting old. But I'm drawing a little bit of a blank, but I know a lot, I'm trying to think of a lot of people. Stephen, you have a much better sense of this than I do. So let me just stop there and let you go.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think as I was listening to Stephen's question, I was going more to institutions rather than to individuals. I think it's fair to say there are individuals like Jordan Peterson and John Haidt and Steven Pinker and Glenn Lurie and John McWhorter and many others who are stepping up and making an impact not only in their professions but within intellectual spheres more broadly and reaching a worldwide. But my sense is the people who probably should get the credit are the people who are building the new platforms. So I don't know who these individuals are, but I can't think of a better platform, say, than YouTube for bringing together diverse people on all sorts of topics and coming up with great algorithms. So if you show interest in a particular topic or a particular individual, you get led to more and more. And so just the huge amount of learning that is going on YouTube, I think, is a great cultural achievement. I would also, in that vein, mention Jimmy Wales and the Wikipedia project, which is now kind of interestingly starting to sound like kind of a standard resource because it's been around for a while. But in historical context, that is an amazing cultural accomplishment to have literally millions of articles crowdsourced and editable on the fly, bringing again together diverse voices and everything that you want, and with very good internal algorithms. So if you show an interest in one thing, it leads you to other things as well. So my inclination then is to start labeling the platforms and to give credit to the behind the scenes people who are creating those platforms rather than to the intellectuals who might be most famously using those platforms right now. At the same time, I also want to say, I think it's early stages for the development of these new technologies. So it might be interesting in 5 years to return to Stephen's question and then say, okay, so where are all of these diverse voices congregating effectively in the new platforms and bringing us together for the great conversations?
I think it's Clubhouse. That's why I'm here. And because you know what? I can invite people in that come from a wide variety of backgrounds. And so that's, I had this record. I'm glad this is being recorded. So this is kind of a setup. So it was a setup question. It's a difficult question. And it's very, very difficult because, you know, I knew probably the Jordan Peterson's Pinker and is you know, atheist. Jordan Peterson, he can bring in some Christian because he's kind of Christianish friendly. But you don't really see any outspoken Christian much on the that are able to bring stuff together. Thank you for your answer. And I really appreciate both of you being here. Your background's phenomenal. I think that the problem that I think Atlas Shrugged in Ayn Rand's work is very, very valuable, very, very relevant to today and being able to bring in people. Because here's the thing, you'd be surprised how many different people can listen to the Ayn Rand type of arguments for things when it's presented with, sometimes the Ayn Rand people can come across as, let me show you how smart I am. And, you know, she has great arguments, and the Atlas Society deserves more places at the table. I'm not just saying that because you're here, Stephen. I think it really does. And I don't think Atlas Shrugged type of the objectivism doesn't get as many seats at the table as it could and should to bring the best ideas, not to bring the best philosophy, but the best ideas. Because if the best ideas don't win, the best people leave. And I think that's across the board in a lot of things. And best ideas mean what does the best for the most number of people legitimately.
Stephen, I do want to try to squeeze in our last two. Yeah,
I'm done speaking. Thank you so much.
All right. No, it was a great question. We appreciate it. Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, great conversation. I would love to see on that topic that you were talking about before, like an intellectual light web, you know, how they have the dark web, but nobody really knows like who the members are or where they're writing. And it would be great to have kind of an open forum for people that are objectivist thinkers to solve problems. But my question has to do with scientism, and I was wondering, there's kind of where it came from and what the philosophical or the epistemological error is. The idea that there's no truth outside of science or anything that you can't prove scientifically. And is that a totally modern phenomenon that came from Marxist thinkers or like the German idealists, or where did this come from? And there seems to be this trend where people are obsessed with it now. They think, you know, anything that's not science is just total opinion. It can't be intuited. It can't be self-evident. It's either science or nothing. It's like almost like science has become a religion. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
And I'm following you, lady.
I'm unmuted, David.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the conventional and easy answer is that science has succeeded in a way that no other discipline has, no other form of, I mean, philosophy moves in its own pace, but it's hard to say that philosophy progresses and builds and has reached certain answers. So people are still studying Aristotle and Plato. Same with art. People are, artistic trends come and go. Stephen has written about a lot of this. They're influenced by other parts of the culture. But science is it relies on assumptions about how you establish scientific truths. Going back to an earlier discussion about logical positivism, it relies on the assumption that you want to observe things, you want to do experiments, you need well-constructed experiments, so there are no, you can eliminate confounding factors. You use statistics and other mathematical techniques as well as logic to induce your conclusions. But the nature of mathematics, what validates mathematics, the nature of logic, what validates logic, the nature of perception, observation, what validates that? Those are philosophical questions. And science relies on those things. So it can't be the only form of knowledge because it's a dependent form of knowledge.
Oh, wow. I would absolutely love to have you in some of the theology rooms. Oh, goodness.
give me a ring.
I will definitely follow you. Follow me back.
All right.
Steven? I have a quick question, more about the meaning of the concept of scientism, which I've always found to be slippery. Sometimes there's a narrow use of scientism and sometimes a very broad use of scientism. So in one sense, scientism can be the view that all knowledge should be scientific in the sense that we should use our senses, form concepts very carefully, run experiments, bring in the tools of logic and mathematics in increasingly sophisticated fashion, and that if we do that, then we should be able to figure out basically everything. But here science is conceived of very broadly, and so all of the physical sciences and social sciences and history and so on will be considered as sciences. But sometimes scientism is used more narrowly, and it gets packaged with some other kind of assumptions that, you know, if you are going to be a scientist, then that means you have to be a materialist, and you have to be non-value judgment person. You have to not make any sort of ethical or moral pronouncements. And so science is only a hardcore materialistic value free discipline, and then scientism means that only things that come out of that understanding of science are legitimate and everything else is garbage. And my sense is when I talk with or observe people who are more religiously oriented, it's not clear to me which of the understandings of scientism they are using, the more robust, broad understanding of science, or if they are using science in this very narrow sense, and then they want to conclude, well, therefore, there's all this other stuff that really is important to human beings that science has nothing to do with, and so scientism is a ridiculous belief system. So for me to say more, I would like to tease out more what conception of science and scientism we're talking about.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, we may not have time for that today, but maybe that can be another new topic as well. Brian, did you have a question? Welcome to the stage.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Honor to speak with you too. And thanks for having me. I work in film industry, and it's been a pretty interesting time. Definitely feels like a change of culture and ideas of free speech, and just the culture of free speech makes me look back, and a lot of other people reflect on, I think, maybe what we thought was a status quo, or reflect on philosophical arguments. And I've really gained a lot, Stephen in particular, from reading your book on postmodernism and Nietzsche and the Nazis, and things that seem like just academic lessons 15 years ago in some college class, and all of a sudden really have a lot of meaning and a lot of reason to analyze. One such thing that I'd love some clarification on or thoughts is, I'm wondering if I misunderstand Karl Popper's Open Society versus, let's say, Marcuse's repressive tolerance. Are they completely in opposition? I've seen it, especially in the meme world online, like both sides have been represented to say both things. I was wondering if Karl Popper's Open Society really was about even allowing the idea that it'll end all ideas. You still have to allow that to be said, while Marcuse is coming from that, you know, shut down the conservative, the right wing side of the argument. Don't ever let it gain steam. I just wanted maybe some clarification on that. And then my second part on the censorship is just, as we face a future of changing technology, post-humanism, just really wild stuff, the power that one human has in their garage and or their pocket on in their cell phone. Are we facing a future where an individual human truly does have too much power to wield, and censorship does become necessary? Hyperbolically, when the high school kid could create a nuclear bomb, you know, in his garage, you know, do we need to be aware of this type of future? Is there an argument for censorship given the technological future we're facing? That's it. And thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Well, let me just take up the second question. I think is another huge one that I don't think we're going to have time for. But yes, absolutely. I think Popper versus Marcuse for mid-20th century intellectual life, those two are in mortal contradiction to each other. You know, Karl Popper was a kind of classical liberal and pushing the open society, open discussion, open debate, free speech as far as it can possibly go. And then Herbert Marcuse very clearly is coming out of the authoritarian left. That's, you know, deep in his DNA, and coming up with just, you know, very fancy state-of-the-art arguments to quasi-justify censorship of any political view that does not fit with his left Marxist commitments at the time. So, yeah, it is an either or, and there is no squaring of that particular circle.
David, did you want to add anything?
Just a quick note, and this is a big topic about censorship and technological advance. You know, the horror example that people use, as Brian did, was, you know, someone designing a nuclear bomb in their basement. Well, nuclear bombs are enough of a threat. I mean, we have means of preventing that. If anyone should do it, when it comes to any form of action, we have intelligence agencies, we have police, we have, you know, you can't do that. That's not covered by the Second Amendment. So, but the extent of power, I don't see individual human power as a threat to any kind of freedom. I think it expands it. In general, I would say, you know, there's a lot of talk about Facebook and Twitter. I don't use them much, but you know, they're gathering information. They have, you know, trillions of dollars and all this information that is marketable. Why? Well, because we enjoy it. They're offering something to us. And the cost is revealing our information to them. So, okay, that's a choice. And someone exploited it and got very rich that way. So I don't see a danger here. But what I do see is a huge expansion from technology. Just in my own field of studying of perceptual, the advances in devices that help blind people or people with other perceptual issues are so far advanced just in my lifetime that, you know, people are now able to work who couldn't work before. I think this is great. If an event comes up, you know, I need a case study. So I think the burden is on anyone who claims that this will cause greater ground for censorship. But I don't see it yet.
Well, that's great stuff. We could have gone longer, but this was great. This hour and a half format really gave both of you a chance to expand on some answers. We had a lot of great audience participation. You know, usually I invite people to the gala at this point, but from what I understand, we are at capacity. So if you are planning to be at the gala, we look forward to seeing you there. Any final thoughts, gentlemen?
Only my thanks to all the participants and great questions, and to my dear colleague, Stephen.
Yeah, same for me. A fun hour and a half. Thanks, everyone.
Great. Thank you both. We'll see y'all soon.